Session, and start with the roll call.
Maria DeAnda.
Here.
Jim D. Martini.
Here.
Gordon Ford.
Here.
Darren Garrett.
Here.
Wes Hall.
Here.
Mike Lynch.
Here.
Ron Martin.
Present.
Clarence Willman.
Here.
Mike Fisher. Linda Stocks Burnett.
Here.
We have a quorum.
We're going to make a few changes. We've had a little bit more attendance than anticipated. There's going to be hopefully some speakers outside, and we'll probably have to go to another session, which is on the agenda for a question at the end, but most likely we'll have to have another meeting to continue any discussion. We need to start with some announcements here. The first one is that the public comment will be moved, which is item number 4, to after item number 7. And Tom, you want to make some announcements?
Okay. In general, we don't normally meet this way. As you know, we have a Wesley W. Hall boardroom at 832 12th Street. We very, very infrequently have more than 5 or 10 guests attending. This is an unusual situation for us. We thank you for bearing with us. This is probably not the optimal place to meet. We probably could have used maybe 300, 400 capacity. We have about 200 to 250 today. We do have most of the people here being able to sit in this room and listen to this presentation. The board at this meeting will not be making any decisions on retiree ad hoc benefits. There are no decisions, there's no discussion about retiree ad hoc benefits. I just want to make that clear. Today we will be seeing a presentation of the actuarial report, and the board will be looking at that. The decisions that are being made today are solely consent items, which are regular retirements that happen every month. Any decision to extend this meeting, to have another meeting, which we anticipate maybe April 24th, but that will be decided at the end of this meeting. So the two major decisions are the consent items, which normally occur each month, and also a decision on where and when we will be meeting again related to the actuarial presentation, which we will be seeing today. So if for any reason you are here solely for retiree ad hoc benefits or want to hear about that, we're not going to be discussing that on the agenda at all today. And I don't know if that helps anybody want to get up and leave, or if you want to say that's fine too. We do want to make sure that everyone has their cell phone off so we don't have any interruptions. And I'm going to look at mine, and guess what? Mine was on. I'm going to turn it off right now. There we go. Okay. Also across the hall are the restrooms, if you didn't see those as you came in. They're immediately across the hall, men's and women's. And then off to your right is a drinking fountain, two drinking fountains. So if you need to get out and go to the drinking fountain or go across to the restroom, then please do so. It's right across the hall. Please be as quiet as possible. Don't disturb people during the meeting. We anticipate that this meeting will be lengthy, related to the actuarial presentation and questions related to the actuarial presentation. And that is why Mr. Ford has called for public comment to be extended after the presentation. Because our focus today is to hear the presentation of the actuarial evaluation report. That is our focus today, and that's the board's focus today. Okay, we are a public board, and we need to meet in public. But the focus today is looking at the actuarial information being presented today. I don't know if there's any other comments. I think that's it for now. Thank you.
I'd also like to add that any written comments can be sent to Tom Watson, of course, as usual. We'll hopefully allow people to give the oral questions and comments, as I said, either today or at other times. We want to be open as possible and allow as much room as possibility. This was the largest room that Tom could find at this time, and we'll try and find the City Hall, County Chambers for a future meeting. It's fairly large, too. But any room has a limited capacity, and we apologize for that.
The other thing I forgot, Hank, remind me, thank you very much, Hank, is that the public library does close, and we need to be kind of out of here. So we want to wrap the meeting up about 5 o'clock, so we're not going to go much past 5. If it gets to be 5 and we need to cut off whatever we're doing at that point in time, that will be the time when we'll make the decision, or shortly after 5, we'll make the decision for the next meeting. You can contact that staff. It will also be on the website. This is being videotaped. This will be on the website. So if you're concerned about watching it or being able to hear it or see it, it will be on the website. We're going to videotape the whole thing, put it on the website, and so it will be available on the internet. So with those parameters in mind, it's the board.
Any other board member have a comment or announcement? Okay. Seeing none, we will move on with our regular agenda, which is consent items. Item number 5, which is consent items.
Mr. Chairman, I move for the approval of the consent calendar.
I have a motion and a second for approval of the consent calendar. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? Okay, that passes unanimously. Stan Sarah has retained Harvey Lederman to give us an introduction, and we're going to let him introduce the framework for consideration as to what's going to be happening. He will be basically doing an introduction prior to the EFI actuary presentation, give everybody a better understanding of the more global nature and how this fits in and how the actuarial process fits in. So with that, I'm going to turn it over to you.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. This is not on yet, apparently.
It is on.
Oh, terrific.
Okay.
No, it's fine. As long as everybody can hear me, is that all right? Everybody hear me in the back of the room, please? Fine? Good? Perfect. Excellent. Thank you. Members of the Board of Retirement and staff and invited guests as well, I'm happy to be here. My name is Harvey Lederman. Some of you have met me before, others have not. I'm with the law firm of Reed Smith. And I had an interesting experience yesterday because I was addressing a joint session of the Board of Retirement and the Board of Supervisors in Santa Barbara County, which has some similar issues as most retirement systems in the state of California do on their financing and their long-term provision of benefits to their retirees. And one of the supervisors asked me a few minutes into my discussion, you say you're a fiduciary counsel. What does that mean exactly? You know, what do you do for the board? And my response, which I hadn't thought of quite in these terms before, but really, I'm thinking of it yesterday, my response is this. My job for you, for my client, the Board of Retirement, is to go into the field and sweep for mines and clear and make sure that the ground that you occupy in exercising your judgment is safe so that you can exercise your best judgment clearly without worry, without fear of conflicts, of not considering the right thing, but considering the wrong thing. So that's really what I do, what I can do for you, and that's what I want to spend a few minutes this afternoon before the actuarial presentation, because the actuarial presentation fits into your overall fiduciary responsibilities, and that's why I want to take a little bit of time to give you that framework so that when the actuary makes their presentation, you have a sense of where it fits in on the exercise of your responsibility. Slides have been made available. I'll try to get through them quickly. And I think if I do that, do it again. There we go. Let's put this in the context of fundamental fiduciary responsibilities. Remember, these are written into the state constitution and the state statutes. These are your duties as board members, trustees, stewarding the assets of this retirement system. And I want to highlight a couple of things because in today's atmosphere, in today's world, today's economic reality, some of these take on different meanings. The exclusive benefit rule is the first rule. The assets that you manage, the assets under your stewardship, are there exclusively for the benefit of the members and beneficiaries of this retirement system. They serve no other purpose, no other purpose whatsoever. They are a sacred trust that you manage on behalf of the members and beneficiaries of this system. Those are the active employees of this county and a few districts that participate, and those are the retirees, the survivors of retirees, and in some instances, the children of retirees. Those are your sacred trust. You owe a duty of loyalty to them. Your duty of loyalty is to act in their best interest. And this is a difficult duty, particularly under current circumstances. You've heard the phrase, you hear it in a lot of contexts, intergenerational equity. And most of the time, that's talked about in terms of, well, we shouldn't push off to tomorrow to our children who are taxpayers tomorrow the cost of financing the system today. But I want to talk to you just a moment about intergenerational equity, meaning that among those for whom you steward the funds. Intergenerational equity here is that your obligation is not only to today's retirees, but to today's active members of the system also, who are to become retirees tomorrow. These assets are for that entire pool. And you've heard, and you'll hear from the actuaries, that we take a long-term view of funding, 40, 50, 60 years out in the future. That means that you're acting not just for today's retirees, but tomorrow's retirees as well. And sometimes there's friction there. But that's your job. That's what you have to deal with, to act on behalf of all of them. And in doing so, you have the third duty, which is the duty to act prudently. To use your skill and judgment and prudence in shepherding these assets. In this situation, that means a couple of things. Here, one is to provide for a sound actuarial-based funding of the system. And that just simply means that if you need to make sure that the trajectory of funds available meet up with the liabilities, the debt, the payments that you owe off into the future, so that you can pay those promised benefits. That the benefits have been promised to the members as they've worked for the county and the other districts in the system, and it's your job to deliver those benefits on a sound actuarial footing. And there's one other thing that is very seldom ever recognized, and it's in the state constitution and it's in the government code, the 37 Act we call it, and it's this phrase, under the circumstances then prevailing. Very important today. The duty of prudence, the duty of exercising your good judgment as trustees of this fund, cannot be done in a vacuum, cannot be exercised looking only at bits and pieces of the overall picture. You must look at the circumstances that prevail. And we all know, I'll jump 5 slides ahead, we all know that circumstances today are not the circumstances economically in the United States, in the state of California, in the county of Santa Claus, are not the same today as they were last year or the year before. And decisions that you make today, prudent decisions that you make today, need to take into account the circumstances that are now prevailing, as opposed to simply resting on what your assumptions were a year ago, 3 years ago, or 5 years ago. Things have indeed changed. Did that work? It's a handy device. They tell me I can also do like that. That might be distracting. Before we get into this, conflicts of interest have kind of hit every one of the retirement boards, you know, worry about it. There's what I call, in the software business, they have a phrase for this. It's called FUD. Fear, uncertainty, and doubt. fear about whether or not, because of something that happened 600 miles away in the city of San Diego particularly, fear about whether you and all the board members can fairly and properly exercise the job that you were put on this board to do. Because don't you have conflicts of interest? Don't you have, for example, see, you know, if you're an active member, as our vice chair is, an active employee in the system, and you're sitting on the board and you're making decisions about employee contributions, isn't that a conflict of interest? If you're a supervisor, as we have Honorable Supervisor Hugh Martini, sits on this board, and you're making decisions about the county's contributions, isn't that a conflict of interest that should disqualify you? And there's a lot of fear out there, a lot of concern about whether or not these kind of interests should take you away from the job that you were put on the board to do. And my answer to you today is, as we go forward, the answer to that is no. You know, their interests, the Constitution of the state and the government code of the state requires people like all of you to sit on this board. The board has to be structured this way. And it's not unlawful, once you're sitting on the board, to do the job that you're supposed to be doing as trustee. It can't be unlawful. There has to be something more to make that wrong. There has to be some personal interest payment that's being made to you. There has to be some breach of fiduciary duty that's made to you that you've bought into. There has to be some trade. That's what happened in the city of San Diego. At least that's what's alleged in the city of San Diego. That there was a trade to underfund the retirement system in exchange for increase in benefits. That's not what we're about in this board. And that's not what you're about in making decisions on actuarially funding the system, which you have to do. It's your constitutional obligation. So I wanted to give you, and I wanted to give this to you publicly, a little bit of guidance. Again, I'm going to clear this minefield of potential conflicts of interest away. So long as the decisions that you make, yeah, I will use this, are within your scope of duty to administer the system. And by that I mean, what is your job here? Your job here is in fact to set the contribution rate and properly fund the system. That's your job. So as long as what you're doing is within that scope, and they don't violate your fiduciary duty, prior slide, to properly fund the system, and no one's bribing you, no one's giving you something in exchange for your vote, and they don't affect you, the decisions you're making don't affect you personally any differently than they do other members of the system or a significant segment of the membership. And there's no contrast between the retirement system and your particular department or with you personally. And if you have an interest, you disclose that on the public record. Then I can tell you that the risk of somebody prosecuting you for some potential disqualifying conflict of interest is insignificant. You cannot be worried about doing the job that you're sent here to do if somehow you think that's going to expose you to potential liability. So hopefully that clears away some of the fud. If anybody has any questions about that, and by the way, please, while I'm talking, going through a couple of slides, if you have questions, interrupt me, ask me. I think it's very important to clear up whatever questions you may have while we're talking through them. Okay? Conflicts of interest. Gotta go that one, right? Okay, I needn't, you can read the newspaper, you don't need me to go through in detail recent extraordinary events. 2008, people refer to it as a black swan event. I don't know if it was a black swan event or a flock of swans. We won't know. We can never know that until you have 20/20 hindsight. But a lot of things have happened economically to impact this system and every system in the state of California. The impact on San Sara has been significant, as you know, and as you've already discussed at your board meetings. Investment earnings have gone down substantially. And remember, you're going to hear today because the actuaries have to take a snapshot in time and then make a judgment about whether the system made its projections or didn't make its projections. And it just so happens that we're standing here in April of 2009, but the snapshot in time that they've had to take is June 30, 08. Now, a whole lot happened since June 30, 08. And so we know that the rate that we'll be talking about today, based on the financial snapshot that they've taken on June 30, 08, are going to look a whole lot different when they take the snapshot on June 30, 2009. And again, I'm going to encourage you, don't put your head in the sand. It's like buying a new Mustang and heading out of Flagstaff at 100 miles an hour trying this thing out, you know. If you know that the Grand Canyon is 10 miles out further on the road, you're going to start backing off the accelerator. You're still on a sunny day and nice clear pavement. And even though they'll tell you as of June 30, 08, there was actually a gain in the system's investment. But you know what happened after that. And to make decisions today, ignoring what happened after that, would not be a good exercise of prudent judgment. Cash flow may have been interrupted in the system. By cash flow, I mean basically the ability to pay retiree benefits on a monthly basis when they're due. Now, I think it's very important to say publicly, right now, especially in front of the folks who are sitting here and care very much about those benefits, that there has been and there is no foreseeable disruption in the payment of benefits out of this system. Do I have that right, Mr. Weiler? That those benefits are not in jeopardy now. They're not in jeopardy for the foreseeable rest of the year. They're not in jeopardy for the foreseeable future. There are enough assets in this retirement system to pay the benefits for everybody who's a retiree. And I think we need to understand that and have that put on the public record so that people don't fear their May paycheck not being in the mail. Yeah. But there has been an impact on the cash flow of the system because money from managers, asset managers of the system, that may have been expected to come in, has not come in without interruption. There may have been, I don't know, there may have been capital calls for investments that you hadn't anticipated. There may be a lot of reasons why that the cash flow of the system has been disrupted. Certainly the assumed rate of return, the 8% rate of return going forward, at least for the last year, has not been met. There's this growing gap, as the actuaries will tell you, between the smooth value and what's happened in the market. When the market goes up, we should be so lucky. When the market goes up 20% or drops 20%, we don't hit the retirement system right away with the high and the low. That's too volatile. So they spread that 20% gain or loss out over a few years. But what we're getting more and more now is a breadth. We're getting that value moving away from the real market value of your investment. And that's a concern to the actuaries, a concern to the system, and it's a concern to the plan sponsors who have to pay contributions based on these values. So the funded ratio, we talk about how many assets you got compared to how many liabilities you owe. That funded ratio has now dropped significantly. But again, I wanted to make that last point. There has been no impact on retiree payroll, and there is no foreseeable impact on meeting retiree payroll. I'm getting better at this. There has been, of course, an impact on the county as well. There's been a disruption because of what goes on in Sacramento. over the budget. Revenues have been affected to the county. Property taxes, vehicle license fees have all been impacted by the economic downturn of 2008. There's been an impact on the membership of the system. Active members are worried about their job security. There may have been, I don't know, have there been furloughs? Have there been voluntary furloughs in the county?
We're talking about it.
Talking about it. Happening in a lot of counties, happening in a lot of cities, happening at the state level. Voluntary furloughs, involuntary, how does that impact benefits? So members are worried about their job security, they're worried about their wage security. And also what's happened has affected people's decisions as to when they're going to retire. And can they retire? Will they be able to retire? Do they have to work longer? I told my I have two sons who are in their late 20s, and I said, well, the good news is that I'm going to keep working. You won't have to support me. I'm going to work forever now. Because my 401k is a 101k. At this point, I said, the bad news is there's not going to be any jobs for you because I'm going to not vacate the seat. So, you know, people may start making different decisions about their retirement choices based upon what's happened in the economy. What's before our board at this session and the next couple of sessions? Best I can identify, you've got the following issues that you need to address in the context of exercising your fiduciary responsibilities. First of all, as the actuaries will explain, there are some errors that have to be corrected, and these aren't minor. These are significant errors from prior actuarial work, past assumptions and methodologies, which will lead directly to increased contributions, at least as they are now projected. That's an issue that we need to address. Another issue will be, well, given the impact of those changes that have to be made and how the actuary goes about projecting the cost of benefits, should we take that hit in 1 year? Should we phase it in over a couple of years? What should we do? This is going to be a very tough question within the judgment of this board. There are going to be issues about the methodology for recognizing these gains and losses. Should we have a corridor? By corridor, what I mean is when that actuarial smooth value of assets starts moving away from the market value every day of your assets, does there have to be a governor that brings them closer back together? Do we have to do something so that we get closer to market value? There's a new actuarial standard of practice that affects how far you can get that, how far that gap opens up before you're stepping out of the bounds mark. Other issues. One that, you know, if there is an elephant in the room, it's this elephant. How about these ad hoc benefit reserves? Are they valuation assets or not? I was at the last board meeting, had the opportunity to observe and listen to the investment report. The what are called ad hoc benefit reserves now represent upwards of 20% of the assets of this retirement system. Current market value of the assets of the retirement system. That's 20% of the assets that are presently not treated as valuation assets, meaning they're not measured against the liabilities of the basic benefit promise to the retirees. And the consequence of taking 20% of your assets and not counting them against your liabilities, your basic benefit liabilities, means that the only other source for getting that money into the system to grow with investment earnings is out of county or the city of Ceres or other plan sponsors out of their contribution. That is a big issue for this board to address. And let me come back to that phrase that I talked to you about earlier in my slides. Under the circumstances then prevailing, that is, the exercise of prudent judgment should be under the circumstances now prevailing. 4 years ago, 5 years ago, that ad hoc benefit reserve did not represent anywhere near what it does today in terms of the percentage of the assets of the system. Things have changed. And you need to look at it again. You need to re-examine that under the circumstances that now prevail and make judgments as to how to deal with those assets. Mr. Lynch, do you have a question?
Yes, just a quick one. Is there a fiduciary distinction between non-vested benefits and vested benefits?
Well, yes, there is.
Can you explain that to us?
I'm not going to give you a hard, bright line. There's no such thing in this business. You know, when you're talking about fiduciary and constitutional responsibilities, there's no hard and fast line. However, there are some priorities. There are some priorities written into the law. The first priority is to assure the payment of the promised vested benefits that are bargained between the plan sponsor and its employees. That is a fundamental fiduciary responsibility. The law gives this retirement board a little bit of discretion to go beyond the promised benefits when there are assets available. And that's a whole other, that could be a whole other day talking about what does it mean. And everybody is familiar with this phrase, excess earnings, one of the terrible scourges of the pension law that we're left with. But there it is. It's an unusual concept even, but it's in the law. And the board has the authority under certain circumstances to use assets of the system to increase benefits. And it can do it through a purchasing power COLA, for example, cost of living adjustment. When people fall below 75 or 80% of their purchasing power due to inflation over time, it can be done through an increased death benefit, burial benefit, whatever you want. It can be done through an ad hoc benefit, like a health care benefit. It can be done through a taxable benefit, like that the system has. And those are things within the sound discretion of the retirement board's judgment to do. The primary obligation, fiduciary obligation, is to assure the benefits that are vested and promised by the plan sponsor in collective bargaining with its union. That is the first primary basis. And you don't want to be in a situation where, by doing something discretionary, you're denying your ability to deliver benefits that are bargained for investors. Now, that said, that's an easy thing for me to say in terms of this ground rule. Whether or not it's mathematicians might call it a zero-sum game. By that you mean if one goes up, the other one has to go down. Whether or not you have to, if you grant an ad hoc benefit, you're necessarily, you know, you grant an ad hoc benefit, you're necessarily depriving a vested benefit. It never comes out that way. The equation never comes out quite as directly as that. But at some point, there has to be a balance. There has to be some sense of balance. And I'm going to keep bringing the board back to the idea that you need to exercise your judgment under the circumstances that prevail today in terms of funding. Your actuary does an experience study every 3 years. That's the usual. And so they adjust things actuarially based on experience every 3 years. You need to make adjustments yourself in your fiduciary duties, in the exercise of your duties, on a regular basis also. So that is a big issue. We're not going to deal with that today, I understand. We're going to deal with that next week and following. But that is a big issue facing the board in this actuarial analysis. Related to it, whether to transfer any assets, literally transfer on the books of the system, by the way, not out of the system, but whether to transfer any assets from these reserves to what are called employer advanced reserves. That's essentially the employer contribution account in the system. And then the third is this business, this idea of excess earnings. How is it possible that a system can have in a year what it calls excess earnings at a time when its debt obligations are increasing? There is a disconnect in the law that governs this system. And I can explain it only to you this way. The funded status of the system, that is, your assets, how much investment dollars you've got, how many dollars you've got in the pot to pay the promised benefit, that's the funded ratio, and you look at that every year. And everybody who goes to all the conferences and says, well, 80% is a good funded ratio, below that's not good. Those things don't matter. The system's going to be out there for a long time paying benefits. The funded ratio is like your balance sheet. Like you go home and you prepare something, if you want to get a loan from a bank or something, they want you to do a balance sheet. You put in, come up with your net worth. And that's your funded ratio, your assets against your liabilities, balance sheet. Okay. Excess earnings are measured every year, whether you have a gain or a loss on your earnings in that particular year. That's more like an income statement. You know, I made so much in my job this year, I had to pay so much out of my job, you know, I've got money. And the funny situation that we've got in many of the retirement systems in California today is that over the last couple of years, on an annual basis, they had these what were called excess earnings. Okay? And it was like making a lot of money in your job. You know, it was a great year, I got a lot of commissions in my job, and I feel really wealthy, but meanwhile, I got this monster debt on my house. And what's my responsibility to my family? Do we go on vacation and spend all this money? Do I pay down my mortgage? And there's this disconnect in the retirement system. And it's written in the law. It's totally not connected. This business about excess earnings is totally disconnected from whether or not you can pay with your assets, the debt that you owe to the members of the system. And so we're probably going to be talking a little bit more about this. You have an excess earnings policy, by the way. And that went in 18 months ago, 2 years ago, 2006. An excess earnings policy, which I think is an excellent policy. And I've read it, and it's, you've made some decisions. You've exercised prudent judgment. You've said, while we have a hole in having built up our assets, we call this a contra account. Okay. While we have a hole, we're not going to be spending money on other things until we fill up that hole. That's what it says, isn't it? What you did, of course, though, was to grandfather in the ad hoc reserve. So you said, we're not going to apply this to the situation we had up until this date. We're only going to use it going forward. But you have a big hole from previously that's being carried forward. So these are issues we shouldn't shy away from them. We should talk about them and resolve them. And that's why the board gets paid the big bucks. Right? Okay. People are concerned. Other boards that I represent and advise have asked me before today, what can we consider? Can we consider the hardship of retirees? Can we consider the county's financial condition? You know, we're supposed to be independent. We're supposed to be exercising our independent judgment. What can we look at? What affects our decision? And I'm here to tell you, I'm here to give you license to take into account all of the circumstances that affect you, the board's delivery of assets, your plan sponsors, your retirees, and then weigh all that in the balance. Weigh all that in the balance. You may, as a matter of law, you may consider whether or not the plan sponsor, in this case we're really talking about the county, which is the biggest plan sponsor here, you may consider whether or not the plan sponsor county is experiencing or likely to experience substantial economic hardship due to its decline in revenue sources, due to its ability to get what I call subvention money from federal and state programs. You know, how do the contribution rates that you will be setting affect the county's finances? Is the county experiencing operational deficits? Have there been reductions in force? Are there furloughs? What happens? Because you know what happens if you start getting a substantial reduction in payroll, both in headcount and in dollar amount, it affects the contributions that come into the system. Because these are payroll-based funding. The actuaries will tell you how much money has to be paid into the system. And then they're going to say, "But and that's a percentage of payroll." But they're expecting, they're projecting a certain level of payroll. And if your payroll is different, then those numbers are all out of whack. So you can't ignore whether or not the county is going through a reduction in force in some way, either a dollar amount, a salary freeze. What's the salary assumption, the 4%? These folks are anticipating year in and year out a 4% increase in your salary, whether merit increases or stepping up or position changes or something like that. If you tell them that you've got a freeze and that's going to last for a lengthy period of time, they've got to change their whole view of how they calculate these benefits. So you can't ignore what's going on in the county, and you shouldn't ignore it. It's relevant, it's important, it affects your decision-making. Will the county or the district who participate in the system have a difficult time meeting the contribution rate that you are going to be setting? Now, when I ask these questions and tell you that it's okay to consider these things, I admonish you, don't just take their word for it. Ask questions. If you're told that the county's budget is X, Y, or Z, get a copy of the budget. Look at it. Ask questions about it. Ask the assessor what's happened to the assessed values in the, you know, in the county. Is there really going to be a substantial disruption in what's going on? You can also consider the ability to meet future obligations. And here's the snapshot for this one. June 30, 2008 is their cutoff date. We know a lot of things happen bad after June 30, 2008. It was about 4 days or 6 days in October of 2008 that the market went into the tank. Are we going to ignore that? If we consider the county's ability to make its contribution this year, and you postpone or you put off the pain of recognizing these losses this year, what's going to happen next year? We know it's going to be a heck of a lot worse. Let's not ignore that. Let's keep that in mind. Will the counties and the district be able to make their future obligation payments that you, when you send them the bill? Obviously, we want to consider volatility of contribution rates. Volatility, avoiding volatility is not in the Constitution, it is not in the statute, it's part of your job. But your plan sponsor cares about volatility, because they need to be able to plan. The city of Ceres, county of Stanislaus needs to be able to plan their budget in advance. So to the extent that we're able to reduce volatility, that is critical. that tells them how many people they can hire in a particular department, or whether they can't hire. So that's something that you may take into consideration. You must take into consideration your own cash flow requirements. We talked about that. You know, you've got, whatever you do in setting contributions and bringing money into the system, you've got to make sure that you can meet your retiree payroll. You have long-term funding obligations that are going to be affected. And in the context of all this, you need to make sure, going back to the Constitution, that the system is funded on a sound actuarial basis. All that means really is that your actuaries have told you that whatever method you choose to bring money into the system and grow it with interest is a sound way of paying those benefits going forward in the future. Okay. I changed the bullet points to the open little boxes because I want you to take a pencil and pen out or whatever you like to use. And today, next week, the week after, I want you to look at the next, what is it, three slides? That's a checklist. The checklist for making sure that the way you go about doing your job, the process that you go about making your decisions is fair, intelligent, and prudent. And if you check off these boxes or keep them in mind, it really, really will help. Somebody said, doing things in the public is the best disinfectant. This is a public board. These are important decisions. They affect your constituency. They affect the retirees. They affect all the members of the system. They affect the public. They affect taxpayers. Please, don't be like San Diego. Let's do this all in public. If there are going to be communications between the Board of Supervisors, for example, and the Retirement Board, let's have those sessions in public. There's nothing better than doing these things in public. I was told in another county about having joint sessions. They wanted to set up a task force of a few of the county officials and a few of the retirement system officials, and they would meet and they would come out with solutions. And I refused. I refused to participate in them, and I refused to approve my client board's participation in that. They wanted to do it, they do it on their own. They're not going to do anything in closed rooms, smoke-filled rooms, etc. You know that. This is important that we do this. I was actually told by somebody on the other side of that discussion, well, we can't be candid in public. And I said, well, I appreciate that as a candid comment, but I want you to say that in public. I want you to do what I want this board to do, whatever it does in public, where the public has a right to know and ask questions. You're going to feel a lot better about it, and you're going to sleep better at night. Give notice to your members in the retiree organizations. It's very important that they get to participate in this process. We're not negotiating over contribution rates and benefits. We're educating, we're learning, and you're going to make a good, sound judgment. The nature of this board, the quality of the board is such that you've been selected because you come from different points of view. That's baked in to this process. It's written in the Constitution. You can't even change it. The only way the configuration of the board can be changed is by a vote of the legislature and a vote of the people of Stanislaus County. It's baked in because the people in the legislature actually think that it's a good idea to have people with all these conflicting interests on these boards making these decisions. So you don't have to negotiate with anybody. You'll come to approve a decision on your own if you follow this process. We're going to identify any conflicts of interest. If anybody has any worries, if anybody on the board believes that they have reason, that they have a personal interest in something, let's get it out on the table, let's disclose it, the best way to deal with it. I'm not aware of any absolute conflict of interest issues right now, but if they come up, let's talk about it. All I've talked about so far is about your exercising your independent judgment and due diligence, so we don't really have to go through much more of that. Ask your actuaries in this process. They're ready. They've got some fantastic software, by the way, and they're ready to demonstrate to you different choices that you have. If then, if we do this, what happens? How does it look going off in the future? I know they've got some good presentations on that. So ask them that. Well, you know, contributions rate to this, or if the value goes down, or what happens if we, you know, we lost 25 or 50% last year? What happens if it's flat next year and then it goes up 14% the future year? You know, work through that. That information is very important. Get their recommendations, which you will have, but make sure that they tell you that what they're recommending is within the parameters of their professional standards of practice. Because remember, they make recommendations. You are not a rubber stamp. I had Judge Fish in Ventura County who tried a case on the board's exercise of judgment a couple of years ago, and we won that case. We defended the board's exercise of judgment, but the judge specifically said, just remember, you are not a rubber stamp of the actuary. No offense, guys. Go back to the Constitution. They make recommendations. You have to understand them, and you have to make a decision about whether they're prudent or not, whether it's a good thing to do. It's so important. You need to understand it. Again, any decision you make determine whether it affects your members' benefits, security. Don't ignore subsequent events. We know what happened in October and December of 2008. Take it into consideration. Consider your existing policies. And if there are reasons to change them, state why. State what's changed. What are the new circumstances that make you change your policy going forward? Identify those things. Weigh these factors intelligently. Don't act arbitrarily. Don't come into a board meeting and say, I got my mind made up on this thing. I know you don't do that, but I have to tell you that anyway because that's what you want me to tell you. And I want you to have it in front of you. And make a complete record of what you do. Very important. If you go forward with this process and you have a complete record of things that you considered, all the things that I've been talking about, if anybody questions your judgment after that, I can defend you in any court of law in the United States. Because this board is not a guarantor of the future. All you can do is exercise your good judgment. We don't know how things will come out. You can't control all that. But you are trustees, and you're only here to exercise good judgment. And if you do that, nobody can second guess you. So I just ask you, please, keep your balance in all this. It's not easy to do. These are perilous times. But I think you'll do a terrific job on behalf of your membership. And I'm happy to answer any questions now, during the presentation, or later, whatever you prefer. Thank you for your attention.
Thank you, Harvey. We'll probably take questions later so we can keep going on. Our primary duty is to have the actuary present their report. So I think if you don't mind, we'll move directly on to that.